Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Bradley Palmer, and I'm joined by Jeremy Fisk and Lee Carlo. On this edition of the podcast, we're going to be catching up with the romantic comedy Crazy Stupid Love. Then we're going to merge into a discussion of films with multiple directors, specifically two. And then we're going to do our Get Your Film Fix podcast game show, in which Lee tells us what he thought of Cowboys and Aliens, since he couldn't be on the podcast last week. And we're going to wrap everything up with our top five on-screen couples that are gonna make it.
25 years of marriage and you have nothing to say?
I'll just say it. I slept with someone.
If you keep talking, I'm gonna get out of the car.
I think the fact that I did it, it just shows how broken we are. Okay. How much we really... Oh my God!
You're getting a divorce?
Yeah.
Amy heard you crying in the bathroom. We all thought it was cancer.
Oh.
Thank God, man.
Yeah, that's my relationship.
Hi, can I buy you a drink?
Uh-huh.
Let's get out of here.
Want to get out of here?
Yeah.
What are you doing later?
I don't know.
I do. There's lots of beautiful women in this bar, but I can't take my eyes off of you.
It's time to go home.
Oh, it's forward of you, but okay.
Yeah.
Should I pull the car around? Have you been drinking? I'll drive.
Hey, ladies man guy. Any tips of the trade?
Your wife cheated on you because you lost sight of who you are as a man. Just take that straw out of your mouth. It looks like you're sucking on it.
Okay.
You're sitting there with a supercut haircut, and you're wearing a 44, and you should be wearing a 42 regular. Credit card. Where are your wallets?
All right, so Crazy Stupid Love stars a lot of actors that we all like here at Get Your Film Fix. Steve Carell, Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone, Julianne Moore, Marissa Tomei. And we'll throw Kevin Bacon in there. Everybody likes good Kevin Bacon appearance. And I was watching this movie, and expecting a lot from these actors, obviously. And despite... you know, above average but not great reviews, I was hoping to get a lot out of all these characters. And as I was watching it, I kind of felt like while this movie and the directors kind of tried to do something with these characters, I kind of feel like they stopped halfway at establishing them. And I want to know if you guys felt like that is what hurt this movie, or if it hurt the movie at all, or if basically there needed to be something more with each one of these characters to make it work as the ensemble piece that it probably should have been.
Yeah, my thought process sort of halfway through this, because I had the same expectations you did, Lee, going into this, because it's been getting fairly good reviews. Not that this matters, but it's got an 8 out of 10 on IMDb. I mean, people seem to really like it. The previews look great, and, you know, we all enjoy these actors, especially, you know, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone a lot. So I came into it thinking this movie is going to have something to offer that other movies don't. And that's what I kept asking myself. What does this movie have to offer that I haven't seen before, or that's different or unique to this specific film? And I don't think I ever found an answer with that. Like, I understand what they were trying to do. They were trying to show the different levels of relationships, the different levels of love, from infatuation when you're a young, you know, middle schooler, and how real that is to you, to infatuation of an older man, to a womanizer who falls in love, to somebody who's falling out of love or getting a divorce. And there was all these different levels going on. And that was kind of interesting, and I wish they had explored it a little more, because that's the only thing this movie sort of had that other romantic comedies didn't have, was that concept of exploring different levels of love. But in the end, it ended up kind of being formulaic and disappointing. I mean, it didn't have anything to offer that a lot of movies have not already shown us.
You know, I think... The difference I have here is that I went in with really low expectations for this movie, because the only reviews I had heard had been not good ones.
Really?
I'd actually heard bad things about it. Because I hadn't really read too many reviews, but I mean, I watched that new Roger Ebert at the movies with those two people, and they both gave it a thumbs down. So I wasn't really expecting much.
Who's on that nowadays?
Ignati Vizhnevetsky, and I don't remember the woman's name.
I'm impressed, right? You knew that guy's name, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he's of Russian descent, I think.
What? That name's Russian?
think so.
I didn't know. It's only online, is that right?
No. It's on TV. It's on.
Oh,
like,
really?
They do. Yeah, because they've always been on like public TV, and so they are on public TV, but then they like send it to all the other public access networks like around the country. So kind of like what they did with like the old one.
I see.
All right, but anyhow, go.
But anyway, so yeah, I went in with really, really low expectations, and actually ended up finding myself like pleasantly surprised. I think just because I was assuming so much less of the movie, so I didn't really find it all that disappointing because I don't think I was really expecting anything more from the cast, like what you guys seem to have been. I certainly wasn't expecting anything revelatory or new. I was actually expecting kind of another lame, boring romantic comedy, which is probably my least favorite genre. And I actually found that the chemistry between Steve Carell and Julianne Moore, as well as Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, really paid off for the film and made me enjoy it more than I was expecting.
You know, this is definitely that kind of movie where expectations play a big part. And it has somewhat to do with the cast and the genre that it's in because... And, you know, I guess expectations play a part all the time, but it's just interesting that, like, given our expectations, kind of laid the groundwork for what we thought about this movie. And, well, I agree with you, Brantley, that the chemistry was fine with these characters. I think everybody played off each other really well, and I thought some, you know, good comedy came out of that. And at the same time, this movie never got too funny, so it wasn't making a mockery of serious issues, but at the same time, it never really got too melodramatic. But did you guys feel like these characters, despite their different actions, were all kind of just the same?
To elaborate
on that, like basically,
yeah.
you kind of have them all, especially towards the end, they're all just kind of looking for the same thing, and that being love, which is kind of the point of the movie, but... I just kind of felt like there was nothing to separate them. Like, basically, you have Steve Carell, who has to move on with his life. And then you have Ryan Gosling, who eventually is moving on with his life. And then the same can be said for Julianne Moore. She's moving on with her life with Kevin Bacon. And then Emma Stone is graduating from law school and separating from her boyfriend. And she's moving on with her life. And the son is going back and forth and back and forth about deciding whether or not he... wants to pursue this crush that he has, but eventually he decides to move on with his life. I feel like it's just kind of like a lot of the same.
I think they were trying to go for that in a way. They were trying to go for different levels of, you know, one characteristic. And I think...
Exploring it through different storylines, I guess.
Yeah, but I think the one person, and I think she was the best part of this movie, was Marissa Tomei, who really...
Oh, really?
I think she was the best part of this movie. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I thought she was the worst part of this movie, aside from maybe Emma Stone's friend.
She owned her character. At least she tried something different with it. She made me laugh.
You mean she wasn't dating a really weird-looking dude for once?
Yes. Well, Steve Carell is yeah.
Well, for I mean, he's
compared
not
to
Ryan
her normal
huge
yeah,
step up.
It's a big step up. You're right. Really, you guys didn't like Marissa Tomei.
I thought she tried
to do something different with her character, and I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
She's a perfect example of what I was talking about how this movie kind of like went halfway there to establishing characters. Like there was a level
of
quirk with her.
She was a smaller character, though. You can't, like...
There was a level of quirk with Emma Stone, and then it just kind of disappeared. I found Marissa Tomei borderline annoying in this movie, actually, as much as I like her as an actress.
Yeah, I don't blame
her completely. It was her character, I think, mostly, that was just annoying.
Well, then you got to blame her completely, because I don't think that character was written as crazy as she made it. I thought she was having fun with it, and I thought she did a really good job and emphasized sort of that aspect of the one-night stand that, you know, something different that you didn't get in any of these other storylines and relationships throughout. So, I enjoyed her.
I don't know. I think she is written that crazy, because I think if there's one area in which the movie is mean-spirited towards a character, it's towards her. I mean, you look what, you know, she goes through in the movie, and then, you know, basically just gets treated like crap for the entirety of it. So I think she probably was written that crazy.
Okay. Well, since it got brought up and about characters getting treated like crap, I'm getting tired of Steve Carell being stomped on all the time. And this isn't nearly to the extent that he's stomped on in the movie Dan in Real Life, but he didn't deserve half the grief that he was getting in this movie. And it even extends to Marissa Tomei. Granted, he, you know, didn't call her and whatnot, and she had a right to be mad and stuff. But, like, the scene towards the end, and a few scenes even towards the end, where he is just, like, everybody's pointing the finger at him, like he's the only one doing anything wrong, frustrates me. And I feel like, for some reason, it's not all – like, Steve Carell ends up in these roles where he's abused.
Well, let's explore that in the context of the story. I mean, you're right. Basically, he's the guy that has to take, I guess, for lack of a better word, the grief from everybody. And it doesn't really always work in the context of the relationships. It doesn't always work with him and Ryan Gosling. And I don't know about you guys, but I felt like that relationship was forced from the beginning. I don't understand why they were ever got together. I mean, there was a throwaway line that Ryan Gosling said about Steve Carell's character, "Will you remind me of somebody else?" Let's say that. And I'm like, okay, maybe that'll come back up. And that never did. So I don't understand. I felt like that relationship was solely forced there so that these other loose ends could tie in almost too conveniently.
Yeah, I think the relationship was really forced between them. And I think they tried to, like, bring it back, like, at the end when Ryan Gosling's kind of talking about, you know, oh, you know, I thought I wanted the bachelor life, blah, 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 but it turns out I just wanted to be like you or whatever.
Yeah, like you didn't see that coming.
Yeah, exactly. And I agree. Like, that's probably the most – I mean, I love the chemistry they had, like, when they were doing it, you know?
Right.
But, yeah, it was just completely – ridiculous and forced setup, the way that they started, you know, that they met, and then that he started kind of mentoring him in the ways of bachelordom, you know?
Right. This movie, I'm all for structured movies. I really enjoy a well-structured film, but this one tried, I think, too hard to make a point on each one of its relationships. With the Ryan Gosling, Steve Carell, it was trying to make that point of, you know, you shouldn't be a womanizing bachelor. And essentially, the writers are like, we got to turn this on its head so that Ryan Gosling realizes he'd rather be like Steve Carell's character. And every one of these relationships in this film had some element of that, where they were forcing something to make a point. And then you have this culmination scene where everybody somehow ends up in the same spot. They don't really explain totally why. And, I mean, it's a fun scene, but without, you know, trying to do any spoilers, but it was a extension of that, like, forcing relationships to get somewhere to prove a point for the structure of the story that may not have helped the story in general. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and this for a movie so set in reality, this movie really stretched the limits of believability. Like, in the scene you're talking about at the end where everybody comes together and you realize this twist of sorts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can accept that, but there's a part of you that's telling yourself that you have to accept that. You know what I mean? Like, you have to convince yourself to accept certain things in this movie. Even though there's nothing outrageous about it, it's just whether it's the structure of the script, the way that they alluded to things, like the character of Nana. They couldn't have come up with a better nickname than that to, like, it's almost like they're trying to dupe you into thinking something that they don't really need to try so hard to do. Like, they could have just left something unsaid. And it forced you to, like, to suspend disbelief in a type of movie that you're not really supposed to do that in.
But, I mean, at the same time, I feel like they weren't really trying to establish very much with Nana, because it's really just used as, like, a throwaway line when they're waiting for the teacher. So it's not as if, you know, you're really expecting it, or that you know that they're trying to establish a character to bring up later in the film.
Right, but and they're clearly trying to make you think that it's, like, his mother or her
well,
mother.
Well, sure, but
they didn't need to do that. It's like adding a thing that they're trying to make you think too hard. It's like, instead of just letting this movie unfold structurally, it tried to add elements of mystery, or I don't know, I'm not even, no, or maybe
no,
didn't
it,
try
it,
to add
it, it no, tried I, to I, purposely hide stuff from you so that it could reveal it later, and the reveal wasn't worth the hiding. I think, like, even with Marissa Tomei's character being the teacher, wasn't worth the hiding. With what we find out about what you guys were just talking about at the end, with what did they call her, Nana?
Yeah, Nana.
They called her Nana. Like, finding that out, not worth how it all went. It actually took away from the movie a lot because you're just like, come on. I like these. I like their concept. I like how they could have had these relationships blossom, but instead they tried to make too much of a point with them about relationships, and it was like, all right, never mind. It's a waste. It's all a waste. All the stuff we've learned about the relationship between Gosling and Steve Carell, it was wasted because it was all for a setup to tell you something else. And it's like, come on, that could have been something interesting.
And even where that setup leads, like, I didn't dislike where the Carell and Gosling relationship ended up. In fact, I kind of liked the way, like, I don't know, the roles kind of became reversed. And
yeah, it's smart. It's not worked, bad.
But it's the transition that they've forced in there. And even though I liked that scene where that transition comes to fruition and there's the big, you know, climactic scene at the get together, I liked that scene. I thought it was one of the better scenes of the movie. It was exciting. It was funny. It kind of encapsulated the crazy, stupid love theme that they were going for. But it was just missing something because I feel like they cheated a little bit. Like they were trying to dupe their audience into understanding what they were doing.
But there's one relationship in this movie I wish this movie was solely about, and that would have been the Gosling and Emma Stone movie. I would have watched or a relationship. I would have rather have seen that movie, to be honest with you. But it could be because I really enjoy both those actors.
Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of that relationship either, and it was partly because I wasn't a huge fan of Emma Stone's character. I thought she was lazy. Her characterization was lazy, and part of that has to do with, and I don't blame Emma Stone, and I'm not even sure I blame the actress, or I don't know who I blame, but it was her friend, who's played by Liza Lapira,
so
who was so one-dimensional and awful that, like, ruined every scene that they were in together.
Right.
Which basically set up Emma Stone's character, because all the scenes at the beginning, they were in together. So it kind of ruined any establishment of her character. And then where she went from there, like, I don't know if I bought it. Like, I don't know. She didn't seem like the... I understood that she kind of wanted to get away and be the rated R version of herself and stuff, but then she didn't become that, and there's that neat little irony where she kisses Ryan Gosling goodnight as opposed to what she said was going to happen. But I don't know. I just didn't really buy into that relationship. It might have been perhaps because he looks so much younger than him, and he's like... I don't know, he's Steve Carell's mentor, and, like, I don't know. Something about that didn't play right for me.
I think for her character, it was the setup that kind of really threw her off, and it you know, is a cautionary tale to directors and even writers to say, you know, these little characters, whether it be her fiancé or be her best friend, need to at least... They don't need to be three-dimensional. They don't have to be totally, you know... ironed out or believable, but they need to. They can't take away. They can't take away from the character you're really trying to portray, and that's what they did in this movie. Both of those characters took away from what we eventually found out about Emma Stone's character, and that really hurt it. And I agree.
And it's interesting because a lot of times you can recognize when a good actor or actress, and Emma Stone is good, I think, and usually they can overcome the bad acting that surrounds them. But that was not the case in this.
It was the fact that they were establishing who her character was, and then, you know, there's nothing she can really do about that if our basis for her character are from these other characters that just fall totally flat.
I don't know. I feel like there was no one relationship in this movie that worked for me, and there wasn't really a relationship that didn't work for me either. Like, they were all kind of just in the middle, and that's kind of what I was saying, where everything kind of seemed the same, and they didn't separate them enough to do different versions of the same. Even it all just kind of felt combined,
Well, to go to your point, it was a little bit montage-y. I mean, there was a lot of those sort of flowing from one scene to the next with, you know, music that just played off as cheesy and almost like a One Tree Hill type of feeling. That
The CW. But without ever being like a full-on ensemble piece, I don't think. Like, it was focused mostly on Steve Carell, and they made everybody else more supporting stories to his story as opposed to making it several different stories, you know what I mean?
Thank you.
All right, so Jeremy, last week when you and I were doing the podcast on Cowboys and Aliens, we talked with Chapin about how you could really kind of tell in the film that there were several writers that had been working on the film over a long period of time. And this film, Crazy Stupid Love, has two directors. So the question I want to pose to you guys is, can you ever really tell that a film has two directors without knowing it ahead of time?
I think you can only tell if the film starts to really get messy, I think. And I mean, and that's only if it's one of those things where after the fact, if you're like, okay, there's two directors, yeah, I kind of saw that, but there's really no actual way to tell it has two directors just from watching it. But if a film starts to get a little bit messy and all over the place, I think that's part of it. And then Lee, it's kind of interesting because I know you're working on a film right now that has two directors, and you've got to witness The Scout. And without saying too much, what is the dynamic like of two directors on set?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm working with Sherry Springer Berman and Bob Pulcini, who directed Cinema Verite, American Splendor, and The Nanny Diaries. And you know, I haven't seen them on set yet, but it. There's clearly, without like seeing them do a lot of their prep and stuff, there's clearly like one of them does one thing and one of them does the other thing. And in fact, it appears, and this is just kind of me from the outside looking in, so I don't want to make it sound like I know exactly how they work, but it appears that Bob Pulcini is much more laid back in what he's doing, and whether or not that's because his aspects of the process or his responsibilities are that way, or if that's just his personality. Like, but it just seems like, you know, one of them makes a lot more phone calls while the other one maybe is just brainstorming all the time, and maybe that's the way they work. But when it comes to the finished product, I think it's a lot of the same with the writers. Like, if you can tell that there's more than, or there's too many cooks in the kitchen, for lack of a better term, then there's clearly something wrong with the movie. Like, we'll get into more of my thoughts on Cowboys and Aliens, but like, you shouldn't be able to know that there's more people involved. Like, basically, directors, if there's going to be two or three or four or however many, they need to be on the same page about everything, and that makes a difference for the way your movie comes out. It makes a difference the way your cast performs, because like, imagine what it looks like to see two directors, you know, arguing about what they want to do with the next shot, or like, and what happens in the editing room, who decides on the final product when it's two directors. There needs to be a very understanding dynamic between the two. And if it's not there, you're going to end up with something like perhaps Cowboys and Aliens with the writers, or perhaps maybe Crazy Stupid Love. Like, I'm sure there are a lot of decisions that needed to be made about where relationships needed to go, how much you needed to establish this character or this character. And, you know, speculating, of course, but if there was a disagreement and the wrong decision was made, that might not have been the case with one director.
Well, I mean, it's always hard. I mean, you could have one director and the wrong decision be made, but I totally understand what you're saying. And you got to do it, I guess, one of two ways. You either both have to just have almost the exact same sensibilities, or you each got to sort of take a certain aspect of the directing process and have it be your own, because it's like, okay, so, you know, who goes and talks to the actors about their performances? Who's the one who's deciding the lenses and the lighting setups? You know, it's like either the two directors are totally meshing and they know exactly what they want, or somebody's got to say, hey, okay, I'm gonna deal with the actors while you deal with the more technical stuff. But it makes it a lot more difficult. But the good thing is, if you can get it to work, you got two brains on it that you can bounce ideas back and forth with.
And that's another set of eyes and everything.
Yeah.
A point I wanted to bring up, which I just think is interesting, is the AD on the movie I'm working on is Woody Allen's New York AD. And he was talking about a little bit of the way Woody Allen works. Obviously, he works by himself, but he is never behind the camera, really. He doesn't watch the shot. He doesn't even yell cut or action. He just says like go and then okay, and that forces partly the AD and also more importantly the director of photography to essentially become another director. Like, that is kind of what it is with, you know, Woody Allen works with this aspect of the filmmaking process. He doesn't necessarily deal with the shot. I understand he doesn't talk with his actors a whole lot. So there's clearly other people that are always doing part of the directing process.
Right, and with Woody Allen, that's a good point, because you can definitely see from any one of his movies, he's more of a writer than a director. It's a Woody Allen movie because of what's on the page, not necessarily what the decisions made behind the camera, and that speaks to that. But going back to having two directors, I mean, I know, Lee, you and I have worked pretty closely together. I mean, through the wood, you were the sole director, but editing and, you know, everything right. else, we you know, had bounced things back and forth. And, of course, there were times where we didn't agree on certain things in the editing room, but I think, I don't know, I think it works out better because you can, as long as you're not on such a tight deadline, you can always come back to something. You can have it out, argue about it, and then come back to it and say, okay. And you always find that compromise, you know, that place where you guys can find the happy medium, and usually that's the right decision. But well, it can also get really, it could also go the totally opposite way with two people and get really ugly. So, I mean, I guess it all depends on a dynamic between two people.
Well, I want to talk about the editing process with two directors because, you know, we edited Through the Woods. We didn't have an editor. We just did it. But we had two sets of eyes to look at every shot and every cut. And the same is to go, and I'm going to put us in the same sentence as the Coens here. They do the same thing. They have their made-up director, Roderick James, and they edit their own movies. But they have two sets of eyes on that movie. And I think something that is always said is that an editor is so important because he is, you know, he's not subject to look at the shots and say, oh, we spent 3 days on this shot. We can't cut it out. He has that objective or unobjective look at the scenes. So if you have two directors and you don't have an editor, it's the same kind of thing. You have those two sets of eyes. You have somebody to argue with over that shot. And a movie that I think, you know, doesn't come up with two directors, of course, because it's only credited with one, is American History X, because of what Edward Norton did in the editing room. And then Tony Kaye, of course, the director, tried to get his name off it, and Edward Norton like wanted himself in the movie more. And I know it's shocking. Edward Norton was tough to work with, but that's kind of a movie that essentially ended up kind of having two directors, albeit not credited. So, and it turned out fine. The movie looks fine. You know, it's great. But
I'm always curious with
that situation that was.
Like with that movie, what I want to see Tony Kaye's version. I want to see compared to the version that ended up coming out. I mean, there's no way to ever tell if that movie came out better or worse because of the issues that Edward Norton had. But it ended up, like you said, it turned out all right. So that's interesting.
There's a documentary. The documentary is about the name Alan Smithy being used, like for people who want to take their names off of films and how it's like the worst kept Hollywood secret.
Right.
There's a documentary and part of the documentary is all about like the Tony Kaye trying to get his name off of American History X. And I watched it forever ago, so I don't remember exactly. But I know that they were saying it's the best movie ever that a director tried to take his name off of. But I think there was the really big rift just between him and Edward Norton, and he was just so offended that Edward Norton wanted to be in the editing room trying to like put himself in the film more. That was the big reason that he wanted to leave, basically, and get his name off the film.
Well, to defend Edward Norton even a little bit, Edward Norton was afraid he was going to become the face of the white supremacists, so he wanted to be in the editing room.
But also, like, to that point, it's like, well, if you're afraid, then don't sign on to do a movie in which you play a white supremacist.
I agree.
I mean,
the interesting thing is that Tony Kaye evidently wanted this movie to be much more about poetry and I don't know. I think much more of like a meditative piece. And then Edward Norton's issue was that he wasn't in the movie enough. So it seems almost like backwards. Like he wanted to be more. He wanted to show up as a white supremacist more often in the movie, whereas Tony Kaye perhaps didn't.
Yeah. The documentary is called Who is Alan Smithy?
Anyway, it's interesting because you have a movie that essentially has one director, but there was basically two people fighting over the directorial responsibilities. and you still ended up with something good. Whereas you can have perhaps a movie like Crazy Stupid Love where let's just say that the directors worked very well together and we end up with something that at times is a little bit sloppy. So, you know, it's kind of a interesting dynamic, and that's kind of the reason I wanted to talk about it, because while you can't necessarily tell while you're watching it that a movie has two directors, like you said, Jeremy, you can go back and look and say, oh, there were two directors. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. I can see where that perhaps made a difference.
All right, so we're going to do another iteration of our Get Your Film Fix podcast game show, in which we try to guess what one of our fellow podcasters thought of a movie. And we did this originally when I was not on the Super 8 podcast, and Jeremy and Lee tried to guess what I was going to think. And we did it this past week on Cowboys and Aliens because Lee couldn't be on the podcast. So Jeremy Chapin and I guessed what Lee thought. And I think we were all kind of unanimous, really, in our thoughts. But Lee, tell us what you thought of Cowboys and Aliens.
Who won, by the way? Did anyone win, or was it all tied?
Wait, wait. But he's not supposed to have listened.
Yeah, but he did. Oh. I know he did.
I listened. You did? I mean, actually, the reason I listened, because I thought it would be a little bit more interesting, because I would be able to, you know, prepare what I was going to say in relation to what you guys thought. So I wasn't just, like, saying something totally different. You guys made that really easy on me by all saying the exact same thing.
Right.
Yeah, we just know you too well.
I mean, overall, I think this movie was just nothing more than a concept. Like, it was kind of a good concept that they just kind of threw on screen. They didn't do anything with it. And it's unfortunate, but that's kind of what it ended up being. It was kind of a blah movie. Like, it was Hollywood's interpretation of an interesting concept. And that's frustrating for me because at one time I was... Or I shouldn't say at one time, but I am a huge fan of Jon Favreau as a writer and actor, but I'm not really a fan of him as a director because he's just so Hollywood. Every one of his movies is just so Hollywood. And, you know, I hate putting that in such a negative connotation because I've always been in the school that Hollywood isn't as bad as everybody makes it out to be. Like, a good movie doesn't just have to be like an indie art house movie. There can be good movies that come out of Hollywood. But here I am saying it in a negative connotation because that's what Favreau's movies are to me. I don't like Iron Man. I didn't bother with Iron Man 2. Elf is cute, but that's about it. And Cowboys and Aliens I thought was not good at all. The best thing it had going for it, I think, was that it didn't really go with this new thing that action movies do, basically responding to the fact that audiences are so impatient now. It wasn't just action scene after action scene after action scene. It kind of had a slow build up, a slow introduction. It hid the conflict from people. It kept some things mysterious. There was a couple good action scenes in the middle, and then finally the big climactic action scene at the end. So structurally, it kind of had this old school action movie way about it, which I liked, but that was about it. I mean, everything else was just kind of there.
Yeah, as far as Favreau goes, though, I mean, I think he's getting... to your point, he's getting more Hollywood, or his movies are getting worse as he goes along. And he has been quoted as saying, and you know, obviously, Lee, you and I are just like the biggest fans of Swingers, and he's been quoted as saying like those type of days and those type of movies are over for him, and he's like gone on to bigger and better things. And to me, he's never
bigger
been
things,
able to
yes, but
bigger things, but not better things. Like, he's never been able to touch the magic he was able to create on this little film called Swingers. And you know, that's the kind of stuff I'd love to see him try and work out again. I'd love to see him, even if he has $200 million, like, let him do that sort of thing. Not that I don't think the studios are making him do anything. I think these are his choices to do these sort of films and do them the way that he's been doing them. But I would love to see him go back to his roots. Not, you know, and on he's sort of a smaller scale of what I would say the same thing about, like, Scorsese, you know? I'd love to see... I want to give Scorsese $10 million and say make a movie instead of $180, $200 million. I want to see what he does when he has to, you know... go out onto the streets of New York again.
And make mean streets again, yeah.
And, you know, make something, yeah, exactly, make something like that, make something similar. I'm kind of curious if we brought these unbelievable talent back down a little bit to their roots, what made them famous initially, what they would come up with. And not that Scorsese's making bad movies at all. I mean, I think
The Departed was kind of a return to form for him with a lower budget. And
it wasn't that much of a lower budget, though.
I mean, it wasn't Gangs of New York or The Aviator, though.
It still was polished. It had that still polished if you looked at it compared to Taxi Driver or Mean Streets or stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true.
But, yeah, that's, you know, with Favreau, it's the same thing. It's like, I'd love to see him do, like, a buddy comedy again. But the thing is
that Favreau didn't direct Swingers. Like, I haven't seen a movie that he directed that's been good. I liked Iron Man,
but it was not. It was more to do with the writing and Robert Downey Jr. There was nothing that Favreau specifically did on Iron Man that made it, you know, great.
I mean, to be honest, and this is a harsh criticism, but right now Favreau as a director is nothing more than a Michael Bay, because he's just the guy who's called the director of these huge studio movies. Like, What is he doing that's making this a Jon Favreau movie? And I don't think maybe he has that as a director. There's directors who don't have that. We put him on a pedestal because of what he did with Swingers, because he wrote it and he's in it. But as a director, he's never been somebody that can stake claim to a movie. You know what I mean? Like, he's just, I don't know, behind the camera, like, telling him where to point it, really. So
I think that's a good point.
And I think Cowboys and Aliens kind of finally put the lid on that for me. Like, I always wanted to be like, oh, it's directed by Favs. I'm excited about it. But now I officially can't say that anymore after Cowboys and Aliens.
I got a question for Brantley, who I know you love Elf, and I know you also enjoy Iron Man, as I do. But would you agree with us as far as the directing style, or would you say that Favreau has something as a director that you can sort of point to and be excited about his next film?
No, I mean, I would actually tend to agree. I think he, you know, the vast majority of his films are these very big budget films that don't really have a ton of heart, really. I mean, I think with the exception of Elf, I think Elf is loaded with heart. And, you know, I've said before, I find the film, like, infectiously funny and entertaining and everything, but I would agree that as much as I like Iron Man, I don't think his films do have a lot of heart, which I think is what is the biggest thing missing for Lee in his films. You know, I know you say you want him to make smaller films and things like that, but I think just really, I mean, I don't really care if he makes big films, but I just think that that's what they're missing. You know.
It's not necessarily that I want him or Scorsese to make smaller films. I'm just curious what they would, like, it would, as an experiment, what they would do if you gave Scorsese only $10 million or you gave Jon Favreau $3 million and you had to make a movie.
I mean, the thing with Favs is he's really only made one small film, and that was Made, and that was for $5 million. Mm-hmm. Everything else since then, whether it was Elf or Zathura or Iron Man or whatever, have been big, or, you know, much bigger Hollywood films. And, I mean, I like Made. It's fine. I don't think it's anything great, though. But it's a decent film. But, yeah, I would tend to agree that besides that, he really has just been kind of a Hollywood director in terms of his directing career.
All directors should be required to do what Soderbergh does. And I think there's a lot of directors that could do what he does and make better, smaller movies. Like, he did The Girlfriend Experiment, which was, I mean, just so obviously an experiment that it wasn't even really that entertaining. But he, you know, he does Ocean's movies, makes a ton of money, and then goes back and does smaller movies. And I just think that's what you're talking about, Jeremy. You'd like to see some more directors do that. The last thing I have to bring up about Cowboys and Aliens, you guys didn't talk about it at all, and I hope that I'm not alone on this, but I just want to know when Harrison Ford forgot how to act. I think it might have been somewhere along the lines when his family got kidnapped, but
You got to be more specific.
Well, the first time that happened, because ever since he's been yelling about his family, he's just been a bad actor. He's not even, like, just turning in lesser performances in lesser movies. But, like, this is somebody – this is, you know, not that Indiana Jones or Han Solo was a huge acting stretch, but, like, you know, this is The Fugitive here. This is Dr. Richard Kimball, who is great, and he's clearly a good actor at one time, but he's just bad all the time now, and he was terrible in Cowboys and Aliens. over the top. Like, it wasn't even like a tongue-in-cheek over the top. It was just bad, I thought.
Yeah, the thing with him is I think he got caught up into this thing where he's almost a cliche of himself, and he understands that, and he knows we as an audience expect Harrison Ford to do a certain Harrison Ford thing, and he's embraced that rather than trying to get away from it. He's totally embraced it, and he wants to give audiences this, I'm Harrison Ford, you've kidnapped my family, and that sort of thing that we see over and over again. And you know what? Until you brought it up right now, I haven't really thought about it because it's just my expectations with him.
You know what I think it is, and bear with me as I try to explain this, because I said the same thing about the new Rocky movie that came out a couple of years ago.
That it was awesome?
No. No, it has actors trying to act like they acted before instead of just acting like the character. So you have, like, you have Pauly in the new Rocky movie trying to act like he acted as Pauly. So they're like adding an extra step that's kind of making these performances go over the top. And I think that's kind of what Harrison Ford is doing. He's trying to act like Harrison Ford used to act.
Well, I mean, it's basically going back to my point. He's trying to act like Harrison Ford used to act because that's what the expectations of the audience are. He's embraced it. I mean, I think we're essentially saying the same thing.
I just don't understand why Harrison Ford has become a joke or a cliche. Like, this is an actor who has given us great performances, and he's been set back now, and he's sort of a gimmick, and I don't understand why.
But it's not, it's weird. It's not like a joke in a way that people look down on Harrison Ford. I still don't think that's the case.
I don't think audiences have accepted what movies are doing with him. Like, I think audiences are
I think they have accepted it.
I don't know if they have. Like, that's why you say I don't think people look
No, I think they've accepted what he's giving us now. I think they've kind of expected it, but it hasn't become like a thing where he's a joke of himself in the audience's eyes, but yet they still they want Harrison Ford to be Harrison Ford, and that's what Harrison Ford is giving them. And you're right. It's boring, and it's trite, and it's overdone. So I would love to see him try to stretch his chops again in a movie.
All those pills and everything, and my legs were getting so sore and all that, you know? Just laying there, I was kind of shrinking and all that. It's great to be outside, you know?
What are we doing here at the zoo?
You know, I kind of like the zoo a lot, you know? It's a special place, especially when it snows. You know, it kind of smells clean and everything like that, you know? Don't you like the zoo? Huh?
I like the zoo.
Yeah, me too. You know, I was wondering, like, what do you think you're doing for, like, the next 40 or 50 years?
What do you mean?
I was wondering if you wouldn't mind marrying me very much.
What'd you say?
If you wouldn't mind marrying me too much.
I'd like to marry you.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
I'll be a good guy, I promise. I ain't gonna do nothing wrong. I ain't gonna leave no hair in the sink or nothing like that. You know.
All right, so it's top five time, and this is how we know we've been doing this podcast too long. We decided on a top five movie couples in honor of Crazy Stupid Love, and just today we realized, oh, wow, wait, we've already done this top five. What was it, episode 26 or something like that?
Yeah, for another
I year. Actually wasn't there, so that saves me. But somehow you two forgot that you'd done the top five movie couples. So instead of like starting over and doing all that, we decided that we're going to do top five movie couples that we think will make it. Will make it as a couple long term. Like the movie ends, they're still going to be a couple moving forward.
So I think the important distinction here, though, is that there has to be some level of doubt that that's the case.
But then how are they the ones that are going to make it?
we have to believe that they're going to make
Personally, we think they're going to make it.
Like, this is why we're excluding Rocky and Adrian. There is no doubt in anyone's mind that they are going to make it.
Okay, well, that works, too. All right, then, Lee, why don't you start us off with your number five?
All right. So my number five, I think, and I kind of rank these based on that level of doubt. So, you know, like, I think that they're going to make it long term, but that might not be the opinion of everybody. So basically my number five, most people would think that they're going to make it, whereas my number one might have a few more doubters. But my number five basically comes from the fact that what this couple has been through could lead to some problems. However, I think there's nothing stopping these two from staying together, even though they've already been together for a long time. It is Matt and Ruth, played by Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek, in the bedroom.
Ooh, good pick. I like that one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. See, I wouldn't have kept them because I don't know if I would have thought that they would have stayed together, quite honestly. So,
why, really?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, me personally, I mean, it's been a while since I've seen the movie, but...
Well, that's good,
know.
Then.
It's
then we're going to have...
all the problems, though, that they had.
Yeah, well, that's good. Now we're going to have different lists, so...
Good, good. Yeah, no, I'm actually glad because that was one that I hesitated to put on my list because I thought, like, who could argue that they would stay together? But, I mean, they definitely have their issues throughout the movie coping with what happened to them, and so I'm glad that there is some doubt out there.
Yep, all right. My number five is Dorothy Boyd and Jerry Maguire from the film Jerry Maguire.
We live in a cynical world. A cynical world. And we work in a business of tough competitors. I love you. You complete me. And I just...
Shut up. You had me at hello. You had me at hello.
You know that.
See, I definitely have doubts about them staying together.
Yeah. Although, I don't know, if that Jonathan Lipnicki turns into, like, a really good athlete, who knows what could happen there.
See, that's a good pick, because that, like, they will stay together because... Jerry Maguire can't be alone, and Dorothy Boyd loves him. But, you know, they don't really make a whole lot of sense together. So I think what makes that a good pick, you know?
Yep.
All right. I went the total opposite direction of you, Lee. I went the ones with the most doubt first, and the ones with the least doubt, I went to my number one.
Okay.
But anyhow, my number five is... Ringo and Yolanda from Pulp Fiction. They're a couple that I think is going to make it. I mean, they're just...
They do everything together.
Yeah, they're made for each other, but if they stay alive long enough to have a relationship beyond that film.
Yeah, I had a similar honorable mention, Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis in Natural Born Killers. Could even go with True Romance as one as well, with characters that are just made for each other.
Yep.
All Tarantino... hands at work there. All right, my number four. It pains me to put this movie on my list yet again, but I don't think it's ever been as low as number four. It's The Apartment. It's CeCe Baxter and Frank Kubelik, Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. Just think they're going to make it.
See, I avoided them because the majority of that movie, they weren't together. They weren't a couple. But
See, that's why I like that, because they finally get together at the end. And yeah, I think that, you know, everybody wants them to make it, but there's, you know, Fran is not the most stable of people.
She's crazy.
So, you know, she could freak out and go back to Mr. Sheldrake.
Right. But she's also on my top five characters I'd most want to date, and she's nuts.
Yeah, that always happens.
That always seems to happen.
The crazier they are, the better.
Right. Yeah.
All right. My number four is Young Love, which is why I have it on here, because, you know, Young Love very often doesn't end up t- turning into a long-term romance. But it is Diane Court and Lloyd Dobler from Say Anything.
Yeah, that's a movie I have to see. Got to revisit that one.
Revisit.
Okay. Yes, definitely revisit. Cameron Crowe. We don't get enough of Cameron Crowe anymore. I think he's on our shit list right now until we get to see We Bought a Zoo.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Because I think Elizabethtown really killed his credibility with us for a long time.
That movie killed everybody involved with it. Yeah. Like,
well, Orlando Bloom should have been killed.
Who has recovered from that? Kristen Dunst is kind of starting to come out of it now, but she had to do a Lars von Trier movie to get out.
Yeah, I almost put Kristen Dunst on my when I wrote my article about my predicting the Oscars. I almost had her as a best actress, but then I realized I forgot Meryl Streep, and I was like, never mind. Bye bye.
No room for her now.
Yeah.
She just missed the cut because of Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep walked by as an extra for 5 seconds in the film, so she got nominated.
My number four is also Young Love, so it's probably not going to last. And it is Ellen and Agnes in Show Me Love.
Oh, I thought about that one.
Lucas Moodyson's film. It's a good couple. I think if they, you know, if they could grow up together and get beyond the high school years, they would make it. But yeah, they're a young couple.
So it's going to be tough for them. But it's I agree. I think they can make it because they're stubborn enough to get through high school with their relationship. All right, my number three movie we don't talk about very much on this podcast. It's Paula Puckrifke and Zach Mayo, Richard Gere and Deborah Winger, and An Officer and a Gentleman. Who doesn't love those two walking off through the...
She's not walking, he is.
Oh, yeah.
He's carrying her.
Carrying her. I mean, that's an awesome ending to a movie, and I just hope that their fairy tale ending continues.
Yeah. That's nice. Mm. That's
good
nice
pick. My number three is a romance in a film that has a ton of romances in it, but it is Natalie and the Prime Minister in Love Actually.
I'm glad you picked that, because Crazy Stupid Love, I think, has a lot of similarities to Love Actually. Yeah.
But Love Actually is a much better film.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, that doesn't include the quality of film. But, yeah, it's kind of the ensemble piece about love and pursuing love and different levels of a relationship, and Love Actually definitely does that a lot better. And, yeah, that's a good one. That's a good pick.
Okay, so my number three is Lauren Alec from Brief Encounter.
That's a good pick.
That's my only number three that I've had.
That's a good pick. Not as good as your original pick of Life is Beautiful.
Oh, yeah, right, whatever. Who would have picked that?
You know what? You could have turned that around on us and say that they'll be together eternally.
Did she die?
No, she didn't die because at the eventually end, she finds her.
Oh. Man, I have to see that movie again. I just wanted to mention it.
You wanted to put a foreign film in so badly.
Well, I already did, so that would have been my second. So there we go.
We need to see more foreign cinema anyway.
Yeah, apparently.
All right, I'm going to move on to my number two, and this is a... this is a couple that just kind of like, just based on their personalities, shouldn't be together. I think all the odds are against them, but I think they're going to make it. And it's Kim Basinger and Russell Crowe, Bud White and Lynn Bracken in L.A. Confidential.
Hmm. I forgot that they ended up being a couple.
Yeah, they do.
I have to revisit that movie.
Oh, yeah, you definitely do.
Hmm. Like also, Life is Beautiful.
Kind of like Life is Beautiful.
I have to revisit that, too.
You really don't have to revisit the end of that one, I guess.
All right. My number two is Andy and Trish. Do you guys know what movie I'm talking about? Any guesses?
Nope.
No? From the 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, I think those two are going to stick together.
That's a good one.
Yeah. That's all I got. So you're up, Jeremy. Like,
right,
any other
up.
Picks where the main
yeah, I'm
has?
Like I'm a little nervous about my number two now because I don't.
It's Romeo and Juliet.
I don't totally remember how they ended up.
Well, those two may be together eternally.
Jack and Rose in Titanic.
Shit.
What's your number two?
I'm really nervous about it because I don't.
Just say it. You gotta say it.
Say it. Come on.
All right, it's you know, guy and girl in Once.
Yeah, they're okay, but yeah, they're But they're not ever together. They're friends.
Yeah, but they're going to get together.
No, they're not, though.
That's what I couldn't remember. They were going to get together.
They're not. She goes back to her husband.
This is my worst list.
Right. Jeremy's the one that wasn't on our original couples thing, so he didn't have to change anything about his list.
Yes, I did, because it was couples that are going to make it. So I originally just had top five couples, and it would have been fine. But these are now couples that are going to make it, and now I'm realizing guy and girl, they weren't.
But they weren't even a couple ever, though.
Yeah, but that would have worked as a couple list.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I still would have argued with it.
You could have argued with it, but it's on a lot of top couples in movies.
Okay.
All right.
So Jeremy's has a top three today.
Yeah.
And then a couple other things he decided to throw on. My turn for number one?
You're number one, sir.
All right. My number one, and the reason I put it as my number one is I think because this could have a lot of doubts about the success of this relationship, but I do think that they are going to make it. And it is Jim and Claudia, played by John C. Reilly and Melora Waters in Magnolia.
Did you ever go out with someone and just lie? Question after question. Maybe you're trying to make yourself look cool or better than you are or whatever. Smarter, cooler, and you just not really lie. But maybe you just don't say everything.
Well, that's a natural thing. You know, two people go out on a date or something. They want to impress people. The other person. Or they're scared that they might say something that will make the other person not like them.
Yeah. That's a really good pick.
Good pick. All right.
Do we even know if they end up, though, together?
He goes to her house at the end and gives her that whole speech that Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't let you listen to.
Right.
Brilliant. And then she looks at the camera and smiles. Brilliant. I think they're going to make it.
All right. My number one is Peter and Ellie, played by Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, and It Happened One Night.
I knew that was going to be your number one.
Of course it is. I love that movie. Yeah. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I especially like it because, you know, they are actually a couple. They're both alive at the end.
Yep. Still together.
Everything makes sense that they would stay together.
Well, yeah. I got another one that's going to have a problem. My number one, there's no doubt that they're going to be okay. And it's Marge and Norm from Fargo.
Yeah. What's the last line of the movie? We're doing okay, Norm.
Or they could have an ugly divorce once the
baby's... That's a good pick. But, you know, good maybe pick. They're not cut out to be parents, so...
Yeah. Yep. Oh, I struggled through this list.
You saved your list with that number one, because I like that list. I like that number one.
Nah, the number one, not the list.
No, yes. The list is an embarrassment to the podcast. Thank God this isn't, like, our 50th episode or anything.
No, thank God.
Which is coming up.
All right.
This is 48.
Something like that. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We want to thank everybody for listening. We encourage you to check out our site, getyourfilmfix.com. If you want to donate, you can do that. That helps us continue to do the podcast, videos, write the articles. Everything that we do costs money. So anything you can donate is greatly appreciated and very helpful. And we also want to recommend people go to iTunes and check us out there. Maybe give us a rating on the podcast or a review. We always enjoy those as well. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
All right, let's do this. I'm ready. Woo!
All right. Is it weird that I'm, like, excited to be back on the podcast?
A little bit.
I was
because
excited.
Because nobody's excited to have you.
Oh.
What'd you think of the last podcast?
That was good.
Yeah. Good answer.
That's all.
Good analysis. That's all.
Actually, I thought it was good, except for your little game show to predict what Lee was going to think. That was stupid.
Because it was all the same. Yeah. Well, we'll find out if we were right. I should have just gone differently just to you know, have a chance of winning.
All right. You guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so Crazy Stupid Love stars a lot of actors that we all like. I don't know, I got a plane going by.
What the hell are you?
Hang on, I'm about to sneeze, too.
I'm at an airport.
I'm masturbating.
Oh, my God.
I told you I was going to sneeze.
I know, but that was just violent.